You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 122 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Hello.
Hello.
We want to start off this week by giving a huge thanks to everyone who came out to last week's live show. A huge thanks to everyone who was a part of the show. And a huge thanks to the famous cousin Katie for her efforts. To the live bingo was a lot of fun. And then also the Trader Bros logo. Everybody at home got a at the show got a chance to see that. We'll have to post that so everyone at home can enjoy it.
Thank you to everybody, to Isabel Manasian, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I went with Manasian, but I never got a chance to ask her. So we just, again, maybe butchering it. I feel very bad about that.
To our friends at Tasteful Profanity Abuse Pod Production, to DJ Infrared,
the star
of the night. I mean, both on the stage and from the crowd. Huge thank you to Infrared for being there. We have to figure out how to work him into something either on the Peltoncast or the Peltoncast Network soon.
Absolutely.
We're also launching a podcast network. To Jake One for helping us decide Seattle's best burrito / taco, which was, again, congrats to Tacos Chuggies.
Yep.
Thank you to Chris Smith, as always, for being part of Talkin' Taco Time. Thank you to our good friends at Taco Time. Look forward to more Talkin' Taco Times coming soon. And finally, thank you again to our good friends at Lil Woody's for both the Peltoncast burger 2 weeks ago, which was excellent. People are still talking about it, I think. And
people are still lamenting that they didn't have a chance to get it, some people.
There we go. Have you actually heard that?
Yeah.
And for providing burgers for the night, having both Lil Woody's and Taco Time at the show was awesome. People there, I think, were well fed.
I hope so. you apparently were not, actually.
I ate nothing.
Yeah.
Which was a cool experience. And, you know, to everybody demanding another live show before basketball season or something like that, don't hold your breath.
Let's not rule it out either. I mean, if people are willing to come, we can do it.
Thank you to everybody who did come.
And then, yeah, absolutely. And then thanks also to Barboza for being a great host for us. Although, we got to work on some Rainier Tall Boys next time, okay? Come on. That's not so much to ask.
Yeah, that's it. We're taking our business elsewhere until they get Rainier Tall Boys. We did it for Lil Woody's. Lil Woody's brought Rainier Tall Boys.
I mean, they even had Rainier. Like, I'd settle for small boys of Rainier. I'm not that particular about Tall Boys. But sadly, we're not drinking Rainier this week. We are instead drinking from Gigantic Brewing Company, their Sassy Pony Hoppy Pale Ale, which has about the most eye-catching bottle I think you possibly can have. The Gigantic Brewing Company, apparently in Portland, Oregon. And let's see. Sassy Pony Hoppy Pale Ale. She's a sassy pony, frisky and hop forward. Hold on for a ride around barrels of juicy citrus and tropical hop flavors. Plus, they've quoted on here, Prince, a strong spirit transcends rules.
All right.
So crack this open, and we can give a toast, one last thanks to everybody who was a part of the live show and came out to it.
All right, and a toast to the beginning of football season. It's finally here. We had to get into it quickly with that UW-Auburn game. Things got hot fast. We'll be back with a special third Pelton brother to talk about that one later. But in the meantime, are we going to get into sports right away?
I mean, I think we should just get right into our third Pelton brother because it's a fan favorite. We welcome in one of our most tenured third Pelton brothers, our foremost cheerleader out there on the internet, who has now become a standout Seahawks writer in his own right for The Athletic Seattle. Welcome back to the pod, Ben Baldwin.
Thanks for having me. Second annual Seahawks season opener podcast.
Let's make it a tradition.
I think so.
Yeah. Second annual.
We'll have Mina every time during the preseason, and then Ben for the first week of the season. It's a nice back to back here.
And then the quality will fall off a surprising amount after that.
No, we might have other guests.
Oh, okay.
All right, let's start, I think, here by talking about some Seahawks news over the past week, some of which we touched on during the live show, but have not covered in a full-on Pelton cast. Starting with last week's trade for Brett Hundley to become the Seahawks backup quarterback in exchange for a 2019 sixth-round pick. Ben, what do you think about this?
Kind of out on this. I think if Russell is hurt, then they're kind of screwed no matter what. I'm not convinced that Brett Hundley is that much better than Alex Magoo, and their logic was that Hundley has actually played in games, but how much does that matter if he is really bad in games? Like, he's a known bad, so why is this a justification for going out and getting him?
First off, you should refer to my Sue Bird backup theory. Like, if you're just going to be in trouble either way, don't invest any resources in it by name. But second off, I disagree with you on this one. Wow. I think that people think Brett Hundley is bad because of the fact that he had to play. And, like, if Austin Davis had somehow played last year, he would have still been worse than Brett Hundley was, in all likelihood. Brett Hundley was fine. And if you look at him in the preseason, which is what we're, like, people are comparing Alex Magoo in the preseason to Brett Hundley in the regular season, and those are two different, wildly different animals. If you look at the preseason, Brett Hundley, over the 4 years he's been in the NFL, has completed 65% of his passes for 7.8 yards per attempt. Magoo this preseason was at 58%, which is shockingly poor in terms of completion percentage, for 6.7 yards per attempt. Do you have a retort?
I was waiting for Tristan to give his take.
I really have no feelings about this. I mean, I guess I don't like giving up a six-round pick, and it feels like, I mean, do we need Brett Hundley? Probably not. Like, the difference between Brett Hundley and Austin Davis is not that great, but it's just...
Austin Davis suffered some devastating injury that sent him to IR last week after he played the entire first half. Did they even say what the injury was? I don't remember.
The main thing that I'm happy about is that Magoo, and we'll talk about the practice squad in a second, but that Magoo's staying on the team on the practice squad.
And making his full salary to be on the practice squad. So clearly they do want to keep him around and see some potential there. Other additions to the Seahawks, they also dealt for former Husky tight end Darrell Daniels from the Colts, safety Shalom Luani from Washington State University in a trade with the Raiders, and then claimed off waivers another Raider, guard Jordan Simmons, and a pair of Cleveland Browns, linebacker Jermaine Grace, and super tall cornerback Simeon Thomas. Do we have any thoughts on any of these additions?
Well, going back to your Sue Bird theory, if they're still trying to get safeties to try to replace Earl Thomas, then that's probably it's probably not going to matter. Whoever they put out back there is not going to be Earl Thomas, so that's going to be one of the concerns going into the season and probably throughout the season. And I think that's the extent of my takes on these back of the roster additions.
Do you think that super tall cornerbacks are like Kevin Youkilis, like for Billy Bean, the Greek god of walks? Like, super tall cornerbacks are Pete Carroll's Greek gods of height or whatever?
Look, everybody has a type. I mean,
that's probably what he thinks.
I would say my big picture takeaway here, besides, you're right that actual aforementioned Sue Bird backup theory actually originated when we were talking about Earl Thomas and how much the Seahawks should invest in backup free safeties. The fact that, I mean, obviously the Seahawks are always going to go out and get some players, and we saw that work out very well last year with Justin Coleman being acquired in a trade before cutdown. But the fact that the Seahawks went out and added so many players, they turned over 6 out of 53 players in the last week here. That to me is a pretty good indication of the fact that their roster depth is not nearly where it was a few years ago, when it was the case that the Seahawks were, you know, players they were cutting were getting claimed by everyone else.
Like Amara Darbo.
Yes. I mean, they did
still happen.
They did have a couple. DJ Alexander got claimed, I believe. I don't know if there were any others, but I mean, there was 1 year where it was like 7 or 8 players they cut got claimed by other teams. It was like they were stalking the back end of other rosters, and now they're picking up multiple players from Cleveland and Oakland.
Yeah, this is more like the first couple of years of the Pete Carroll era, where they're just churning the roster, hoping to find somebody because they know that there are places that people can step in and contribute.
I don't know if this matters.
I think it's a troubling sign is what I'd say. So in terms of other the injury moves that relate to the roster, Austin Davis, Jamarco Jones, the aforementioned Austin Davis, Jamarco Jones, Byron Maxwell, and Eric Walden all placed on IR as part of the cutdown, which means they cannot play this season, cannot be removed from IR this season. The only way they can come back and play is if they reach an injury settlement and are waived with that. JD McKissick then was placed on IR after the roster cutdown, so he is eligible for one of those two IR designated return spots after at least eight games. Ed Dixon placed on the non-football injury list because he's been unable to practice so far at all. And then Deion Jordan was activated from the PUP list. And Pete Carroll said at Monday's press conference that there is a chance he plays in week one at Denver, although that is still not a certainty.
Jordan even having a shot to play is pretty surprising and probably good news, although we should take everything with the Pete Carroll injury grain of salt here. the other interesting thing is I think a lot of people are wondering why they carried six running backs on their initial cut down to 53. And I think now we have the answer is they wanted to have the chance to bring back McKissick later, even though it won't be in the near future, as discussed on a previous Pelton cast where his injury can certainly linger longer than most people might be expecting.
And I think that's the most sensible move. I know some people have said, well, what's the point of using an IR return on JD McKissick when he's, you know, your fourth or fifth running back? But the fact is, I think a lot of those time, those that second, one of those designations is probably going to go unused, and teams should probably be a little more aggressive about using it earlier in the season.
Yeah, I think that's right. Trying to think of an analogy where, like first half timeouts or something, coaches are probably not aggressive enough using them because they're usually going to carry too many into halftime. And this is similar where if you have a chance to use it on a player who's actually good and who was actually a contributor last year, then might as well bring him back. Running back is a position with very high attrition rates. So someone on the roster now is probably going to get injured anyway, and they'll probably want McKissick at some point.
I think we'll also know a lot more about CJ Procise by that point, because it's been very difficult to get a read on where he is physically in, you know, kind of playing out the string in these preseason games.
Yep, he missed a couple games, I think, and then I attempted to watch the fourth preseason game and got about a quarter of the way through it and then gave up, so I don't know how he did it now.
No grit, Ben. No grit.
This is the first year that I've watched the fourth preseason game in like 6 years. do we think CJ Procise sees the field against Denver?
I mean, I haven't run through the numbers in terms of who's going to be active or not. I mean, it does seem like Mike Davis has maybe overtaken him as the third down back at this point. Yes.
Which seems kind of crazy because Procise is like basically better at everything than Mike Davis. So if it's a choice of which one of those people I want on the field on third down, if Procise is healthy, he would be the person I would want out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the question is, you know, I saw someone suggesting on the Seahawks Reddit that, you know, did we just overrate CJ Procise all along based on this relatively small sample of successful performance? And I think the answer, I mean, probably is a little bit.
Yes.
Because it was two games. But I also don't know that he's necessarily the same player physically that he was at that point when he's gone through the number of injuries that he has.
Yeah, and I think it's fine to question who he is as a runner, but as a receiver, I both on tape and in college where he actually played the position, like he's a good receiver for a running back. So if we're talking about just using him on third downs, then he gives you a lot of options in terms of splitting out wide, even like taking dump offs. It was something that he was good at when he was actually healthy. So if he's healthy, then put him out there. And if he's not, then it'll probably be time to move on for him soon.
A lot of draw plays on like 3rd and 14, setting up Michael Dixon punts.
We'll get to that. Oh, don't jump ahead here. Okay, as you mentioned, the practice squad is set. Five players carried over from the Seahawks training camp. Another sign, I think, of the fact that they don't love the depth of their back of their roster, that they brought in five players from other teams.
I think this is normal that they do that.
That's a lot. I think it's usually like two or three. I think five is a high number. So they kept over Magoo, a pair of wide receivers, Caleb Scott and Keenan Reynolds, who I think was pretty close to making the cut. Guard Jordan Roos, and then cornerback Akeem King, another player who saw a lot of action during the preseason, and added from the outside another former Husky, LaVon Coleman, Marcus Lucas, who was with the training on the practice squad in 2016 and in training camp last year, and then tackle Elijah Nkansa, defensive tackle Frank Heron and linebacker Antoine Williams, who are football players.
For King and Bruce, they both struggled mightily in preseason, so I'm not surprised they didn't make the roster. For Bruce, he's the player who came in when DJ Fluker was injured against, I'm pretty sure this was the second game against the Chargers, and he just really struggled, so I'm not surprised that he wasn't selected to make the roster. For the practice squad, I basically just wanted them to keep Alex Magoo, and beyond that, I don't really have any strong takes here.
I still like Keenan Reynolds. I like Keenan Reynolds, and of course love them signing LaVon Coleman. Like, to me, I was saying this to Kevin offline. Let's say that for some reason Penny isn't back and Chris Carson and Mike Davis aren't playing. The running back who's on the roster in any capacity that I would like to be the feature back is LaVon Coleman.
I still feel like this, if JD McKissick's healthy, like it wouldn't be crazy to just run him out there as the running back and throw a bunch, but that's obviously not going to ever happen.
He's on IR right now.
He's on IR. Reynolds, to me, is a perfect practice squad player in terms of someone who's converting from playing option quarterback in college to playing wide receiver in the NFL. This is the place for him to get that kind of experience, development, and still be part of the Seahawks system while not counting on the 53.
Yeah, it sounds like he impressed the people who were at training camp and then had a couple nice moments against, I think it was the Vikings in the third game. So it's nice to see him sticking around.
Caleb Scott is the player who would have been featured on Hard Knocks.
I don't know what his backstory is. Seahawks Twitter was abuzz Monday morning with the news that Earl Thomas was in Seattle and a photo of him at SeaTac Airport on Monday morning. Then Pete Carroll added some fuel to the fire by making his song of the day, the song Free, 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 which naturally related, of course, to free safety Earl Thomas. Now, Ian Rappaport cast a bunch of cold water on this later in the day when he reported that Thomas was just in town to take his kids to school for the first day of school here in Seattle. And then Pete Carroll, when asked about it at his press conference on Monday, said there was basically nothing new to report. Ben, we've talked a little bit about how we expect the situation to play out. What's your take on what's going to happen with Earl Thomas?
Yeah, it's hard to know. It feels like a situation where all the parties are doing what they think is in their best interest, and the fans are just unhappy with that. For Earl Thomas, I think he's seen what happened to Cliff Avril and Cam Chancellor and wants to make sure that if he does suffer a career-ending injury, then he is taken care of financially and playing on the last year of his deal. He doesn't really get that. And from the Seahawks' perspective, they probably feel that they've been burned by having such a huge share of their 2018 cap spent on players who are not going to be on the field, so they want to protect themselves. Now, Earl Thomas is such a good player that if I were running the Seahawks, which obviously I'm not, then I would probably just say we're probably not contenders without Earl Thomas. He's that good of a player. So if I have to pay him at the top of the safety market and give him that financial security, then that's fine. It would only be paying him through his 20s and into his early 30s. So if the Seahawks were willing to do that, it probably would have happened already. So that's why I'm kind of not optimistic about him ever playing for the Seahawks again. So at this point, it probably just comes down to getting the best compensation they can. And going back to Pete Carroll's song of the day, free, free, free. If you love something, set it free. And the time is probably coming to set Earl Thomas free.
Wow, bringing it home. I was going to say we should stop searching for meaning in Pete Carroll's songs of the day, but you did it. You know, if the Seahawks were able to find the kind of compensation for Earl at this point that the Texans got from the Seahawks last year for Dwayne Brown, the second round pick and third round pick, I think we just end up being thrilled with that situation.
Oh, yeah, totally. What is the minimum that it would take for you to be happy with trading Earl Thomas, which is such a depressing sentence?
Yeah, I mean, so at this point, I'm basically thinking of it as you're just trading however many games Earl Thomas would be willing to report. I mean, I think I've, you know, somewhere around 9 or 10 is probably my expectation for him. So for that, I mean, I'd be okay with a third round pick for that, I guess, but I don't even think that's out there.
Yeah, third round pick. I mean, the real answer is I'm not okay with any of this.
Right.
But given the situation that the Seahawks are in or have put themselves in, we kind of have to be now because they've made their stance on it known that they're not going to sign Earl to a long-term contract.
You know, Mina touched on this last week saying that Earl Thomas was a three-win player. How much of a swing as we kind of transition to talking about our expectations for the Seahawks do you see in terms of Earl Thomas's value over the course of a 16-game season?
When I looked at this, for two consecutive seasons, he's been the difference between when he's not on the field, the Seahawks have been about an average defense, and when he's been on the field, they've been one of the best defenses in the league. So if we take that at face value, then it's a huge deal. I don't know exactly how to put a win number on that, but and there are some sample size issues and which quarterbacks they get when Earl's on the field versus off the field, but if it happened for two seasons in a row and we're talking about a decent number of games now, then coupled with what we can observe when we see how much ground he covers, we know that defending the deep middle part of the field is really important, and he suppresses both the number of attempts against that area and how good they are. So putting all this together, I think it's not crazy to think that he does move the needle in terms of how many games we should expect the Seahawks to win. And I was kind of skeptical about that when he first got hurt in 2016, and I have been proven to be very wrong.
But the Seahawks have Tedrick Thompson now, so everything's fine.
Anytime you can replace Earl Thomas with a safety in the 10th percentile of the spark, you got to do it.
All right, I wanted to kind of walk through as we look at like the outlook for the season as a whole. This is something we talked about doing, Tristan and I, when the Seahawks made their coordinator changes, is what kind of, you know, results do you expect in terms of DVOA this season in each of the three phases of the game? What were reasonable expectations for those coordinators coming into the season? Back then, we didn't know exactly what the roster was going to look like, didn't know that Earl Thomas was going to hold out, didn't know that Paul Richardson and Jimmy Graham and Sheldon Richardson would all be lost via free agency. Did I miss anyone in there? Oh, Michael Bennett and Richard
Michael
Sherman.
Michael Bennett, Richard Sherman, Cam Chancellor, Cliff Avril.
I mean,
if you're scoring at home,
Cliff Avril and Cam Chancellor, we did have a pretty good idea about at that point. Okay, so let's start on offense, where the Seahawks finished 14th in DVOA last year. What do we think is a reasonable baseline for this year's Seahawks offense in terms of DVOA, Ben?
I think 14's probably got to be the baseline. There's not a lot of reason to think that they will get better. The one place for optimism that will probably look pretty silly in the next week or two is that their offensive line did look better, especially in pass protection in the preseason. And having a full season of Dwayne Brown certainly should help. Not having Mark Glowinski and Luke Jokel certainly should help. If they can stay healthy, which is a huge if. So I wouldn't be surprised if they finished like somewhere in the 10 to 12 range. And anything above that, it would be because Russell Wilson has pass protection and just goes nuts. I don't see any other path to being like a top offense.
Yeah, I don't want to, I mean, reasonable expectation is a hard thing to do because I don't want to put the expectations too high on these coordinators.
Well, just take the coordinators out of it at this point. Just what do you expect for the Seahawks going into this season?
I think that they should be a top 10 offense, given that they were close to it last year. The losses on offense aren't as important to me as I think having the consistent offensive line and hopefully, I'm going to knock on wood here, consistent running back play from somebody like Chris Carson. I think that Russell Wilson with time is one of the top two or three quarterbacks in the league. And if they can get him enough time, the Seahawks should be in the 8 to 10 range.
I'm going to also say about 12th. I think I share Ben's concerns. I mean, you look at, first off, we haven't talked about Doug Baldwin's injury in the
fact that
he's not likely to be 100% this season, which is another big hit to a receiving core that already looked distinctly unpromising. I have been encouraged by the fact that we've seen the deep ball be very effective for the Seahawks, kind of the red line throws that were a hallmark of the 2013, 2004, 2000, actually, let's, yeah, the the 2012 through 2014 teams. Let's go back all through those 3 years.
If I could take a silver lining from the shoddy play calling through the preseason, it's that the Seahawks were throwing the ball down the field a lot, and that's what we want to see.
Would you say he's been taking some deep shots?
Yeah. God. It works so well. It's either shoddy play calling or he's taking deep shots.
It's true. You've got options either way. But you look at just the talent at the skill positions besides quarterback, it is not great. Not great.
I was trying to think if there's another team with the worst tight end depth chart, and I did not succeed.
How
Maybe
dare you talk that
Denver?
Way
about... Who's Denver throwing out there at tight end?
Well, Jake Butt.
Yeah, I mean, they have a tight end who I think has never played in the NFL, right?
Well, I mean, most rookies have not played in the NFL. I don't know what you're asking about. Like, they're starting?
Well, he sat out all last year, right?
He did, yes.
He was drafted, yeah. So, yeah. I mean,
we'll get to that in a second. But he's currently behind Jeff Huerman on the depth chart.
I mean, it's not exactly a terrifying tight end room. Is there a tight end room?
Yeah, there's a tight end room.
Okay.
Yeah, they show it on Hard Knocks from time to time. Okay, maybe let's switch over to the
defense.
That's
when they come up with flute dances.
Yes. Let's switch over to the defensive side of the ball, where the Seahawks finished 13th last season. What are reasonable expectations for this year's Seahawks defense, which probably is also largely contingent on how much you think Earl Thomas is going to play?
So I'm just going to assume he's not going to play. And from a talent perspective, they've just taken such a big step back, both with him and the Sheldon Richardson-Michael Bennett combination rushing the passer. So it's just hard to see how they would be as good as last year. So maybe like an average defense. And if they're better than that, then Pete Carroll is an actual defensive magician, which is certainly possible. But after the offseason, I'm just kind of... Pete Carroll has me a little bit wounded, so I'm in wait-and-see mode.
Wow.
I think that's completely fair.
Yeah, no, I mean, average defense feels about right to me. I'm going to say it's 16th.
Yeah, I think we're all in that same ballpark there. So then the last phase of the game...
Well, just really quick, I mean, you talked about the pass rush. Without players like Bennett, Averill, I mean, you're putting a lot of pressure on Frank Clark and then an injured Deion Jordan and a rookie in Rasheem Green.
Yep.
I mean...
Yeah.
It would be hard for them to live up to that kind of potential of what they're losing from Michael Bennett and Sheldon Richardson from the inside, even though we like a lot of the players that they have.
I mean, Clark's been very productive, but it will be a little bit to do that is the number one pass rushing option, the guy that opponents are game planning for on a week in, week out basis. That hasn't been the case for him in the past.
And even if he's as good as he was last season, there's still a massive amount of production missing from Bennett and Richardson. Like, between the two of them, they pressured the quarterback more than 100 times. So who's going to be replacing those pressures?
Okay, then special teams. The Seahawks finished 20th there last season. And I think if there's one place you can feel optimistic about their chances for improvement, other than maybe running back rush DVOA, I think special teams, they have a chance to be dramatically improved this season.
Yep. Punting should be, like, if they're not top three in punting, it'd be a pretty big disappointment, which is crazy to see about a fifth round rookie punter, but I've definitely been drinking the Kool-Aid there. Place kicking, not as optimistic about, but hopefully he'll just be like an average kicker, which would be an upgrade over what Seattle had last year, I think.
Right.
And hopefully Tyler Lockett will be up to full speed after he spent last year recovering from his leg injury.
And then also, I think Shaquem Griffin's addition on the coverage team should be beneficial for the Seahawks, especially when he's not starting at weak side linebacker.
I mean, this was the group that, in the Pete Carroll, John Schneider era, they should be most disappointed about, it feels like, were special teams last season, given that it's something that the Seahawks really care about.
And invested a lot of resources into before last season.
If they're not in the top 10 special teams overall, I would be probably disappointed and surprised.
By the way, we should touch on, we missed this in the news because it feels like it happened several years ago at this point, but it was still within the past week. Ben, you want to go into your thoughts on the Tyler Lockett extension?
Okay.
Do you want to make the case for Paul Richardson?
Yeah, so I had a hard time understanding why they, if they had a chance to match the Redskins' offer on Paul Richardson, they didn't. So the deal was, I think it was 5 years, $40 million, and something like $17 million guaranteed. which is a lot less than people thought. I think when we talked at the early part of the offseason, we were expecting something along the lines of the Devontae Adams deal, which was like 4 years in the high 50 million. So Richardson getting that little money and the Seahawks not taking him back was pretty disappointing. And what everybody told me in response was, oh, it's the Seahawks. They don't invest in wide receivers, so this shouldn't be surprising. Now, how do we reconcile that with Tyler Lockett getting a lot more money per year, more guaranteed than Paul Richardson, even though Richardson was definitely the better player in 2017? And yeah, Lockett's 2015 season was very good, but he hasn't reproduced that since, and he's been injured since. So of the two players, Paul Richardson is the only one that we've seen produce after his injury, so we should probably feel better about his health going forward. And he was like 75% of the cost of Lockett. So, and he's taller, he's better at, he has a better catch radius. He had a lot of nice kind of jump ball chemistry with Wilson last year. So the whole thing just doesn't really make sense to me.
Ben, what you're forgetting here is that while the Seahawks may not invest in wide receivers, they do invest in kick returners.
Yeah, which is a good thing, given that the NFL is probably going to get rid of kick returns sometime very soon.
But even the baffling thing about this, like you're saying, is that if you could choose either one of them in a vacuum, I think all of us would probably choose Paul Richardson as a player, right?
I mean, the three of us or all of us as Seahawks fans? Because it turns out the answer is very no to that question.
No, the three. I mean, I think Tyler Lockett is definitely much more of a fan favorite than Paul Richardson is, partially probably because of those kick returns. Because if you have one good kick return, every single bad kick return or touchback or whatever is forgotten.
I mean, I did make the case that Tyler Lockett was the second most valuable kick returner in the league last season. Now, you know, it's a little hard to separate that from blocking and things of that nature. But I do think that's some of the value he provides. I'm just not sure. You still got that. That still pales in comparison to the value that one can provide as a receiver.
Yeah. And if it was an option between the two players at the same cost, then maybe I could sort of see the argument for Lockett, but at a huge premium, I just don't understand.
Okay. should we talk about record prediction then for the season? I mean, what are you thinking for the Seahawks this year?
I think 8-8 is the most likely, and it's kind of just a distribution around that. So that would be what I would pick. So if the line were set at 7.5, I'd pick the over. If the line were set at 8.5, I'd pick the under. If the line were set at 8, I guess I would look at a picture of Russell Wilson and take the over and not feel great about it. So I think that's where I am.
You tear up the picture of Earl Thomas and look at the photo of Russell Wilson and take the other.
Yeah, I think we could make the jealous girlfriend meme with this somehow too.
You're definitely right that you basically start there. There have been seasons in the past where you start with 10-6 or something, and you kind of look at the distribution from there as kind of the average record. But I think you're right that 8-8 is probably what you would consider like the median record for the season. Is there a chance that they win more? Of course. Is there a chance that they win up to 11 games? Probably. I don't know about beyond that. You know, the percentage chances that get infinitesimally small. But sure, 8-8.
I mean, there's a lot of variability in the NFL. Teams, you know, teams come out of nowhere all the time. So I don't know if it would be stunning if they won. It would be surprising if they won 12 games this year. I don't know if it would be stunning. And then on the other hand, is so many national media members have been quick to point out, in the unlikely event that Russell Wilson were unavailable because he decided to follow Sierra on tour at some point this fall or whatever other reason that might be, then the Seahawks you look at the rest of the talent on the Seahawks and you're looking at a team that, yes, probably is in contention for a top five pick at that point.
Sure.
Yeah, it's interesting going through the schedule and looking for games that you're pretty certain the Seahawks are going to win, and there's not a lot of those games. So it's really hard to know what to make of the season.
That was something we thought about doing at the live show as part of our season preview with our friends at Tasteful Profanity, a Beast Mode production, but ended up getting cut for time. What do you think about kind of, if you look through this schedule, the way it sets up, starting with three of the first four on the road, and then a really backloaded home schedule where you've got a lot of difficult opponents coming to CenturyLink Field?
Yeah, so the six games before the bye week are at Denver, at Chicago, Dallas, at Arizona, at Rams, and then the Raiders in London. So if they're going to be good this year, then the games they basically have to win are the Raiders game, the Bears game, the Broncos game, which we'll talk about in a second, I'm assuming, and probably the Cowboys game since it's at home, and probably the Cardinals game. So if they're not getting through
that stretch, you named all the games.
But if they're not getting through that stretch with a good record, the back half of their schedule is just so insane that we should probably be really adjusting our expectations downward. Like, it's just a at Lions, Chargers, at Rams, Packers, at Panthers, 49ers, Vikings. Like, that stretch is just, it's such a hard stretch. So if they're not sitting pretty at their bye week, then it's going to be really tough going forward.
It's set up kind of nicely home road wise, though, where you kind of like to have a lot of home games at the end of the season. And, you know, the secret to the NFL is that we have no idea what's going to happen with any of these teams. The difficulty of those games, we could have done this last year and looked at that Eagles game at the end of the year and not said this is going to be a huge game. Or the two Rams games that happened. Games that ended up being very big games against very good teams that before the season we wouldn't have expected to be. Some of those teams that we're looking at in the second half of the year that look like very hard games, some of those teams will be in bad positions. Things will have happened to them or they'll just come out and play worse. We don't know. But so you kind of like that sort of the easier games on the schedule, which are definitely not easy games, are happening in the front half and they're on the road if you have to. So if you can get to 3-3 by the bye week with all those home games left after that, I think you could get to 10-6.
That's pretty optimistic. I would be pretty scared.
I mean, one interesting thing will be how that influences their thinking with Earl Thomas. If you do get off to a slow start with the back half of the schedule, do you then just figure, okay, Earl Thomas is not going to provide us any value, so whatever we can get for him in trade, even if it's like a fifth round pick, then we're taking it.
Yeah, I think that's probably reasonable. If he's not going to come back, then the best you can get for him is a third round comp pick in 2020, and even that's not guaranteed if they go out and sign a bunch of players over this offseason, and I think they will have the cap space to do so. So it'd be really depressing to be giving up Earl Thomas for basically nothing, given that he's Earl Thomas, but it might be the best out of all bad alternatives.
Well, this was depressing.
Or they could just re-sign Earl Thomas. Jesus fucking Christ.
If you'd like a more optimistic thing to think about that tangentially involves the Seahawks, wanted to make sure I plugged Sarah Spain had a great feature on ESPN over the weekend that involved former Seahawks running back Sherman Smith. And not going to say much more about it than that, because then it would kind of spoil the story.
Running backs coach.
Oh, did I say running backs? Yes, running backs coach. Yes.
Should we talk about the game that's going to happen this weekend? Because we're finally in game week for the NFL. Let's talk about Seahawks Broncos week one.
We should, and I think this will be an interesting matchup because, of course, we have a lot of questions about how the Seahawks are going to look after all their offseason changes, but perhaps even more questions about how the Broncos are going to look after a disappointing season for them and their big change going out and upgrading the quarterback position by signing Case Keenum to a 2-year, $36 million deal coming off his career year for the Minnesota Vikings. Ben, do we think Case Keenum is for real?
I wouldn't say for real, but he can still be not for real and be a substantial upgrade at quarterback for them. The biggest red flag on Keenum is that if you look at his splits, when he is pressured versus not pressured, he did very, very well when he was under pressure. And that's kind of one of the stats that is most unstable from year to year. There's just so much randomness into what happens once a quarterback is under pressure that it's unpredictable. So if he goes back to being a normal quarterback when he's not, when he's under pressure, then we should expect some regression there. And he's also not going to be playing with two incredible receivers. Sanders and Thomas are good players, but they're not up to the level of Diggs and Thielen. So it would be pretty surprising if he were in the top five or whatever of QBR like he was last year. But even if he were worse than that, he could still be an upgrade over what they had last year.
Right. I mean, Trevor Siemian had the worst QBR among qualifying quarterbacks last season. Keenum was number two. Yeah. So yeah, if you, there's a lot of space in between to explore where if he's just an average quarterback for the Broncos this season, he'll still be a massive upgrade on what was the number 31 rated pass offense last year in the NFL by DVOA. And they also hope to have improved their receiving core. You mentioned Sanders and Demaryius Thomas, the holdovers to the going all the way back to the Super Bowl 48 days. Good times those were, but they've turned over kind of the rest of the depth chart at wide receiver, drafting Cortland Sutton out of SMU in the second round, and then a familiar face, unfortunately for Huskies fans, in Deshaun Hamilton from Penn State in the fourth round. Hamilton had five catches for 110 yards and two touchdowns in the Fiesta Bowl against the Huskies last year.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything of Denver in the preseason, but the random fantasy people that I follow have been saying good things about them. I don't know if this is like actual good things or what they want to see after hyping them up throughout the draft process, but both of those guys were kind of darlings of that community. So it'll be interesting to see how they do in their first years.
And it sounds like Sutton's going to play a lot. He's, when they go to three wide receiver sets, he's been playing as the boundary receiver, and they've been moving Emmanuel Sanders into the slot where he played much more in Pittsburgh and hasn't played as much so far in his Denver career. You go. Or did you have anything?
Oh, no. I thought you were talking to Tristan. Sorry.
Broncos also hoped to upgrade their offensive line by adding Jared Veld here from Arizona for a sixth round pick in a trade this offseason. I would say that Garrett Bowles on the other side is sort of their Jermaine Effetti. Had allowed seven sacks last year and committed 10 penalties. So some Effetti-esque numbers there from another former first round pick.
Yeah. In Effetti's defense, at least he wasn't over 30 years old when he was drafted. So he has that going for him.
That's true. God.
Slight exaggeration. But
So another rookie getting an opportunity for the Broncos, Royce Freeman, another familiar face for Huskies fans from his time at Oregon, will start at running back, according to the Denver Post. He was drafted in the third round and averaged 5.6 yards per carry during the preseason. The Broncos waived their incumbent starter, C.J. Anderson, who's now in Carolina. And Devontae Booker had been running with the first team most of training camp, but has averaged just 3.6 yards per carry during his first two NFL seasons and was not as productive as Freeman during the preseason.
Yeah, it seems like Freeman is definitely in line to get a huge workload, and it'll be interesting to see how he does in the NFL. I was really surprised he didn't come out after his junior season, I think it was, the one before this past one, but good for him. He got drafted in the first round, is now in a pretty good situation, at least in terms of getting workload.
Definitely.
Well, and he to me is the scariest weapon that Denver has. And it's going to put a lot of pressure on Seattle's linebackers and the defensive line. I mean,
including presumably Shaquem Griffin, as it sounds exceedingly unlikely that KJ Wright's going to play this weekend.
With, you know, we don't know what these Broncos quarterbacks from last year, all of whom I think have been released, right? Trevor Siemian, Paxton Lynch. Are they on teams?
Simeon's on the Vikings. He got traded to the Vikings.
Okay.
They basically swapped him and Keenum, except one of them got way more money than the other.
We don't know how much of that was the Broncos offense around those quarterbacks. Case Keenum, we know, was in a great situation last year and is not going into a great situation. You know, the receivers will test the secondary, this young secondary, but I'm most concerned about Royce Freeman in this game.
I mean, if you're asking me the question, was the issue in Denver last season Paxton Lynch, Brock Osweiler, and Trevor Siemian, or was it Demaryius Thomas and Emmanuel Sanders? I think I know where my take lies.
Or could be
on
the offensive line.
Yes, like, the offensive line was not great.
I mean, we're looking at years since Demaryius Thomas has been a productive wide receiver.
And also years since the Broncos have had a capable quarterback. So probably those go hand in hand. Let's talk about the defensive side of the football, which has been historically Denver's strength, had a bit of a down season. I mean, you could make the comparison, I guess, to what happened to the Seahawks defense the last season and a half, where, you know, Denver didn't maybe have as long a track record of success, but you look at their Super Bowl win with an aging Peyton Manning really propped up by their defense, which was among the very best in the league, dropped last season to 10th overall in DVOA and 15th against the pass, despite that highly touted secondary and the pass rush led by Von Miller. And we've seen some dramatic changes there as well, where Aqib Talib was traded is one of the starting cornerbacks. Bradley Roby, who was in the slot, will now be moving out to be a boundary corner. And then short-lived Seahawk Tremaine Brock taking over the nickel role. But the big addition, of course, is number 5 overall pick Bradley Chubb, who's going to slot in opposite Von Miller, rather, as a rush outside linebacker in this 3-4 scheme.
Yeah, Von Miller and Bradley Chubb in a week one road game is actually pretty terrifying. It's a good thing they have Dwayne Brown, so that's one side, but Jermaine Ifedi against presumably predominantly Von Miller is actually pretty terrifying.
It's not great.
Von Miller is probably better than Melvin Ingram, even though Melvin Ingram is a very good player, and Ingram just had his way with everybody during that preseason game.
Oh, God.
And that was a game where Joey Bosa wasn't playing on the other side, so you didn't have that kind of complimentary bookend pass rush.
Yep.
Great. But the offensive line looked pretty good against Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
That was an encouraging performance.
Minnesota should have an equally similar pass rush to the Denver Broncos.
Yeah, I think the same category.
Von Miller's probably a bigger star, a bigger one-man player than anyone Minnesota has, but the Vikings have more in depth and in the interior with Sheldon Richardson. So it's definitely, like, I don't think there's a clear answer between the two. If I got to pick one unit to have my team, I think I'd probably pick the Vikings just because they have so many guys.
So we're going to hang our hats on that game. It's like the 2015 yep. season for the Seahawks offense, where we assume that that's the baseline for everything. This one game against Minnesota is what we're going to hang our hats on for the offensive line.
That sounds about right. That checks out.
All of that said, this is still Bradley Chubb's first ever NFL game.
Yes.
I mean, like, the expectation for him shouldn't be what his eventual potential could be.
Of course.
It's him coming in as a rookie. Like, is he a highly touted rookie? Is he probably going to be good? Yes. Is Von Miller scary going opposite Jermaine Ifedi? Obviously. But this Broncos defense didn't do a ton to improve themselves over the offseason. In general, there's not a ton to like from the Broncos going in this year, unless you're a huge Case Keenum fan.
I mean, I think they're fine. They're hashtag fine to me. The one thing we haven't mentioned is their rush defense was very good still last season. They had the third best opponent rushing DVOA, so maybe not the best first test of whether this revamped Seahawks offensive line and run game can get going.
They're kind of the AFC Seahawks in a lot of ways, like you mentioned, right. But they don't have the quarterback.
Yes.
But
probably.
Another similarity to the Seahawks is a huge improvement at the punter position.
These two teams went out. I mean, what a perfect place for Michael Dixon to make his debut at altitude in Denver to just really showcase everything he can do. And on the other side, his veteran opponent, Marquette King, inexplicably released by the Raiders in one of John Gruden's first moves after taking over the organization this offseason and landed with their AFC West rivals in Denver. The Broncos last year had minus 8.8 points on punts, according to Football Outsiders metrics, and the bottom, below average in every single special teams category in terms of Football Outsiders DVOA. But the Raiders were plus 4.8 points in that category. And incidentally, the Seahawks were minus 13.4 points on punts last season. Safe to assume that's going to improve this year.
Oh man, it's going to be a fireworks show. Both teams are going to try to run the ball and probably not succeed, and then we're just going to see a lot of punts, and they're going to be amazing punts. So hashtag I'm really looking forward to this.
Fireworks show. All of that said, Ben, as we go into week one, really, somehow, a huge game for the Seahawks in week one, a game which will probably tell us what we should expect from the entire season from the Seahawks team. Ben, percentage chances of victory?
So I have a piece coming sometime this week, and I'm pretty concerned because Denver basically never loses at home in September. And yeah, so they have a bigger home field advantage than any other NFL team just because of their altitude. And if you look at teams in other sports, the Nuggets have a big home field advantage. The Avalanche also have a big home field advantage. The question is why this is most pronounced in September. I don't have a great handle on this, but I'm guessing it's something like people aren't in condition to be in game shape. So the disadvantage of playing at altitude when you're not acclimated to it is perhaps exacerbated during these early games. But going back to like 1990, the Broncos have won something like 85% of their home games in September. And this is a sample size of more than 50 games. So it's pretty concerning. The Broncos have been pretty good during this span, but they've only won like 60% of their home games. At other times, the NFL average for home victory is something like 56%. So if you think the Seahawks have better than like a 15% chance of winning, then that would be more likely than previous teams have won in September in Denver. So I'm going to go with like 20%.
Wow. That was some awesome stuff, which we did not know about and is making me revise my...
I know. I mean, I was starting out like, you know, 40, 45% range. I mean, I feel like if you put these two teams on a neutral field, I think the Seahawks are slight favorites at that point. So really, It's just a question of how much home field advantage you want to give Denver.
Yep, agreed.
Which in this case is probably a lot, as Ben has just told us.
I mean, I assume that probably there's some regression in the mean that should be expected from that stat. Like any time there's that dramatic an outlier, odds are some of it is just randomness over that period. Yep. But I'm probably going to go like 30% for the Seahawks now after hearing that.
I'm gonna go 40%. I revised that down from 45.
Do you guys want to guess the record of the Seahawks in road openers under Pete Carroll?
Oh, God.
I know it's not like, great. I can
their first road game of the season.
Okay, I'm trying to think of any. They won at Carolina.
That's the one.
When what you're talking about with conditioning, it kind of reminds me. I think there's that game in Tennessee last year, which was week 3.
Yeah.
Where it was a hot day in Tennessee, and I think the Seahawks, especially against the run, just looked overmatched. I think there was maybe a big Derrick Henry run in there.
There was a big time of possession difference in that one, you'll recall.
Yeah, I mean, again, hopefully that doesn't happen. It seemed like that was happening a lot last year. But that's kind of what you're reminding me of, is something like that, I suppose, I could see happening. Maybe the Broncos have the ball for 40 minutes and the defense is out there for a ton of the game, and they're kind of just able to grind it out.
Yeah, so it's hard to know how much to read into all this previous stuff, but just given Denver's home field advantage, given how bad the Seahawks have been on the road on their first game, given how they play on grass, I haven't even brought that up yet.
Yep.
It just seems like all these things together, like it's so easy to see like them not succeeding well on offense early like they did last year, and then being behind with Denver's home crowd and then Von Miller rushing the passer. Like it's not hard to see how they could end up losing this game, even though they're a better team. So even if they lose, it's not like their season is doomed. They just got exceptionally unlucky with what time they drew this Broncos game.
Counterpoint, possibility of a 75-yard Michael Dixon punt.
Worth it.
The Seahawks, like, take the opening kickoff, go 5 yards, punt from their own 25, and he pins Denver out of bounds at their own one. That's the scenario where the Seahawks win this game.
If that happens, then the season was a success.
Yeah, even if they don't, it doesn't matter.
Agreed.
They can lose if that play happens for the highlight reels. It's not going to be fun. You just describing that outcome. I think we can all see the game already.
Yeah.
We've seen this game before, and you're probably right that it'll happen again, and God damn it.
Wow. What an appropriate way to wrap this up. So speaking of frustrating season opening losses, let's recap the Washington Huskies 21-16 defeat to the Auburn Tigers in the Chick-fil-A kickoff game, at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta last Saturday. This was one the Huskies definitely could have and perhaps should have gotten the victory against a top 10 opponent in what was effectively a road game. Ben, why don't you break down for us why that wasn't the case?
There were a couple of reasons why the Huskies lost. And we can talk about if we had to assign blame or responsibility, where we would start with. So kind of at a high level, the Huskies gained more yards per play than Auburn, 6.1 to 5.2. But because Auburn converted so many third downs, they were 9 for 18 on third downs and then converted their one fourth down conversion. That just meant they kept so many drives alive. And I kind of went through their drives where they scored and looked at on each drive, there was this key play where Auburn had a third and long, and the Huskies just could not get off the field. And we kind of saw this a couple times last year against Stanford and Penn State, where it was, I don't know if third down defense is real or if the Huskies are just getting really unlucky, but it kind of just keeps happening in these big games. So on the very first drive, Auburn had third and seven at the Washington 10. They scored a touchdown on that play. On the second drive, Auburn had a third and 12 from their own 35 and converted that. They got 3 points on that drive. On the drive close to the end of the first half, right before the Washington touchdown, there was a third and nine. It looked like the Huskies had gotten off the field, but there was a defensive holding flag thrown. And then they got 3 points from that drive. And then on Auburn's final touchdown drive, what ended up being the game winner, they had a third and nine at their own 25. The Huskies rushed two people for some reason, and then they converted that. And then later on that drive had another third and seven from the Washington 10 and scored a touchdown on that play. So if just a couple of those third downs go differently, then it looks like such a different game. And this could have been a game that Washington won pretty convincingly. There were these key plays. I haven't even mentioned Washington's red zone offense yet. Some key plays that if they had gone differently, the Huskies could have really kind of put the pedal to the metal and excelled in this game. And it just didn't work out. And it's really frustrating.
Reinforcing what you said, the Huskies more yards per play, but Auburn in this game ran 81 plays to 65 for UW because of all those factors. And then I don't think you threw in the two turnovers for the Huskies.
Yep.
The Jake Browning interception where the tight end did not come back for the ball. And what looked like he was going to throw it away turned into an interception that really wasn't on Jake, was on the tight end on that case, as Chris Peterson emphasized. And then also the ill-fated triple option play where his pitch was deflected and recovered inside the Auburn 10 that, maybe it turns out that Jake Browning is not a triple option quarterback.
Oh or a draw from the Auburn 7-yard line on third and goal.
Jesus Christ.
That was an interesting play call. There was some interesting stuff there in the debut as play caller.
So the worst thing about this is, I guess I have one statement and a question. First, do each of you feel like the Huskies need to win out now to go to the college football playoff?
I mean, probably. It certainly wasn't a great first weekend for the Pac-12 if you were hoping to raise the profile of the league as a whole.
It's never a good first weekend for the Pac-12.
It really does seem that way, doesn't it? UCLA losing at home to Cincinnati, Arizona losing at home to BYU. Not great.
Yeah, I think probably. The other two teams they're playing out of conference aren't amazing, and maybe BYU will be okay, but...
Yeah, I guess that's a good news. It was a non-conference win for the Huskies' other non-conference opponent there.
Yeah, so it's hard to see them losing two games and then making the playoff, given the perception of the Pac-12, whether that's warranted or not.
I mean, the good news is that it's such an early loss, and if you want to lose, you want to lose early. And it certainly wasn't a case where they were overmatched or looked like they couldn't compete at this level. Like they checked every box except actually winning the game.
That's the thing that's so frustrating about college football, is in the NFL, if you lose a game, whatever, you move on. Everything's equal. You have playoffs in the end. You play each other. But optics matter so much in college football, and people have so many predetermined notions about the SEC that I don't feel like the national...
But you keep saying this, but the SEC is winning these games. That's why they have the notions.
I don't think the national takeaway from this game was, wow, the Huskies could have won that game. Or the Huskies played better than Auburn. It was the Huskies played an SEC powerhouse and lost, and that's it.
I think it was a lot of the Huskies beat themselves.
I don't know if that's what we're seeing.
In December, nobody's going to remember anything other than that, they lost to Auburn.
Yes.
True. I mean, so the good news here, I guess, is everything we've talked about, the reasons they lost this game, do tend to be the things that are less sustainable, that carry over less than the fact that you outgained a top 10 opponent in terms of yards per play in what was effectively a road setting.
Yes. If we can rationalize this game.
Oh,
I mean, we can rationalize the hell out of it. The first quarter was scary, and you kind of thought for a second, wow, maybe the Huskies are just bad.
The G-Chat conversation between us got very dark for a moment.
It gets dark quick often.
Especially the Sounders were losing 1-0 for a while there. It was like, man, sports are bad.
I had no idea that the Sounders were even playing. But from the Huskies' standpoint, they went to basically a road game in a hostile environment. It was loud when they were on offense and outplayed Auburn.
With two offensive linemen, for all your preaching last week about the depth on the offensive line, sadly, with Trey Adams coming up with a back injury in practice that, according to Adam Jude, will keep him out much of the season.
I just feel bad for Trey Adams. I think that the Huskies line will end up being okay. They did pretty good in pass protection most of the game. I mean, There were some big breakdowns, and there are other times where the running game, there just weren't holes or whatever. But in general, they made enough plays, and it's Auburn. So, like, you're not going to expect to just be able to pummel them every single play.
Right. And especially, again, with two players making their first career start on that line. But it turned out not to be experienced after all.
But I feel bad for Trey Adams because he is somebody, this injury is going to hurt him after being injured last year. And he is somebody who could have been a first round pick.
And there's also just the frustration if you work so long to get back from the ACL injury. It's not like even a recurrence of that. It's something, you know, I mean, I don't want to say unrelated because of the fact that we know that often there are these connections in the body, but, you know, not a recurrence. It was an entirely new injury.
Backs are bad news too. Like putting any timetable on a back injury is like, you just have no idea.
Yep. And the thing about Chris Peterson, though, and this is the good thing about, and we have felt this way about Pete Carroll for years also, is you just have so much faith in a Chris Peterson team that after that first quarter that they're going to settle in and get it together and figure things out. And they did. Right? Like, they figured it out. That game could have got, if that was a Steve Sarkisian team, that's like a 50-3 loss.
Yeah. So the first time when the game was happening, I listened on the radio, and the first like few drives I was hearing Taylor Rapp's name so much, I was like, this is not a good sign if your safety is involved in so many plays. But after that, they look like the better team. After those first two Auburn drives, they just didn't win the game.
And if I'm Auburn, my takeaway from that is we should not run the ball. There were some inexplicable play calling from Auburn.
But the fact that they had the threat of the run, that the Huskies were so concerned about the threat of the run, I think is what set up so much of what they were able to do in the passing game. I pointed this out, I think this was early in the third quarter on Twitter. At that point, they were 10 of 11 completing passes on first down, because anytime basically they passed in a run situation, you had, you know, kind of out of those RPOs, receivers streaking wide open through the UW secondary where Taylor Rapp was left to deal with them.
Does it lessen your enjoyment of sports knowing how much of them is determined by just random things like red zone and third down or three pointers?
Huh. I mean, it probably adds to the frustration when your team loses because of those things. And you do, because instead of getting upset, you can't like get upset at anyone. Like, yes, there's probably some quibbles to have with the play calling. I know Tristan has a take to come on the refereeing, but it's just like you just kind of have to throw up your hands to the heavens in some ways, which I guess is probably the origin of a lot of how humans have operated for many billions of years.
You know, I think it's fun. Like, I had a great time watching the game in a lot of ways, especially when the Huskies were leading. And now I just keep thinking through these plays. There's the one pass that was going to the end zone. I think it was Aaron Fuller who was open, and the ball just gets tipped away. And you're just like, God damn it.
Yeah, Coach Pete pointed
out. Why did that have to happen? Like, why do you run the triple option on this crucial third down? That one. And then also, so after they call the targeting on, who is it on? Or on JoJo McIntosh, a targeting that was pretty clearly not a targeting and ended up getting overturned, which was good that that happened.
System worked as intended there.
But why can't you go back and review targetings after? If it needs to be called on the field, then you can review it. Why can't you, at the commercial break, have somebody signal down and say, hey, that's a targeting or whatever?
I've always said we need more review in sports.
For target, this is an important play, right? Targeting is different than reviewing like where the spot was or something like that. And when Jake Browning gets hit on that third down and there's no penalty for targeting, it is egregious. Everybody saw it.
Well, not everyone saw it when it happened, but that's another story.
A few key people did not see it.
Well, and also that it happened to the quarterback, too. I mean, that is the one place where you should be watching for it more than any other position. And that's happening to the quarterback and gets missed by all the referees, that should be reviewable.
Yeah, there has to be a referee whose, like, area is the offensive backfield location. So I don't understand how he did not notice that. And being on the field, like, he had to have heard the helmets collide too. Like, that makes a sound, but I guess not.
I mean, so it's just these small, crucial plays. But also, Aaron Fuller, I mean, come on!
That was maybe the most exciting part of this game to me, was the performance of the Huskies receiving core. I mean, Ty Jones had a great catch in there. Maybe tried to go a little bit too much to the fade to him in the end zone, but yeah, Fuller was phenomenal.
Quinton Pounds going up and getting it. Odell Beckham-style touchdown.
That was exciting. I had to admit, I Googled Aaron Fuller after the game because I hadn't really heard much about him before, and his Huskies bio from last year, they had things like caught one pass against Arizona State and things like that. And now he's having this huge breakout game for the marquee game of the weekend against Auburn. So it's really cool for him, and good sign for having a better receiving core than last year.
It was also very confusing because I'm pretty sure he changed his number over the offseason to number two, and I had to look up who is this number two. I figured out Taylor Rapp pretty quickly. I think he also changed his number because he was 21 before, right? Am I right?
That sounds right.
Okay. Do we feel like there's any need to have a Jake Browning conversation after this game?
I don't think so. I don't think he's why they lost. Like, he could have played as well as he played, and the Huskies could have won against a top 10 SEC team basically on the road. So I don't think there needs to be like a referendum on whether Browning can win a big game for him. I think the one real big costly mistake was choosing to pitch when he did, and that's on him. And maybe the play call was bad, but he could have mitigated that by just not turning the ball over.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you've got so little experience running that kind of play that to me, it's much more on the play call.
Also, wasn't there a run on 2nd and 13 on that last drive?
1st and 15 and 2nd and 13.
The last drive in general, the pace that they were going at, I really don't like. And I think this is a thing that Pete does too, where you expect to score, especially down by more than a field goal, where they're not going at any sort of hurry up pace. And you're just saying, we're going to score here, not give them any time. I would rather play that situation. I understand you need to have confidence or whatever. I'd rather play in that situation
or whatever,
going into it, assuming that you're not going to score. And then you blow that timeout on the defensive drive before then. So you don't have three full timeouts, the whole host of timeouts. Maybe that's why you have to play that series differently. But just the approach on that series, and this is, I'm sure, not Jake Browning. I don't know who makes this decision between Bush Hamden or Coach Pete, but it was frustrating.
It was probably a learning experience for Bush Hamden. I mean, it was his first time calling a game out at this level, first time since he was at Arkansas State many years ago. So.
Well, I'm like Bush Hamden, who's coming in, his like the thing that they put below it is that he was the quarterback coach under Steve Sarkisian for the Falcons. It's like he's probably the most hated offensive coordinator in the league last season, who in the end I think probably had a fine season, but showed such a massive regression from where they were at the year before from Kyle Shanahan. It's like, great, that is your claim to fame right now, Bush Hamden. Anyway. It's frustrated.
The last drive was extremely frustrating. And like the pessimistic view is that they were too scared to put the game in Jake Browning's hands, and that's why they were so conservative. And then the optimistic view is that they were certain they were going to score, so they wanted to do it when there was no time left. But running on 1st and 10 and then 2nd and 13 puts a lot on the third down. And in that series, they actually converted. So that was when Browning scrambled for the first down on 3rd and 11, I think it was.
Nice,
but like, you can't count on that happening. And then in the next series, I think they ran on 2nd and long again. And then they got into that 3rd and long situation. And that's where that was kind of Browning's other mistake, I thought, was taking that sack rather than throwing it away. Although it only would have made a difference of like 3 yards or something. And then on 4th down, Browning just had no chance because he was under pressure immediately.
Right. Yeah, it looked worse than I think it was from his standpoint. I mean, that just was a situational thing. Well, the good news is the Seahawks.
But also, one last thing. Where the hell was Savon Ahmed in the first quarter?
That's a great question.
Like, did Bush Hamden forget that Savon Ahmed was on the team?
So I wonder if they had some sort of plan for him that was contingent on them getting like multiple first downs in a series, and that just never happened.
And then Savon would come on.
Yeah.
Because when he came in the game, I mean, he had the one carry that was bad, but after, or maybe a couple, but instantly breaking things, he looked like Savon Ahmed right away.
Yeah, he looked good.
It's an injection of speed, which is very much useful. So the Huskies will get to take out their frustrations on North Dakota this Saturday. A bit of a drift contrast in terms of opponent ability. North Dakota came into the season ranked 156th in the Sagarin rankings, which include both FBS and FCS. That ranking would make the Huskies approximately 48-point favorites going into this game, although obviously you get a little wonky when the divide is that large, and you know the Huskies will surely be giving their backups plenty of time. Expect to see Jake Haner get his first opportunity to play as a backup quarterback this weekend. Some of the depth at running back, who we haven't really seen very much of. North Dakota did beat Mississippi Valley State 35-7 in their season opener. The win for quarterback Nate Ketteringham, who's a transfer from Sacramento State in his first year as a starter. And in that game, they managed to hold the Delta Devils to minus 27 yards rushing.
Wow.
So there you go.
Is this the Pelton Cast college football rushing yards should not be, or sacks should not count as rushing yards stat?
I mean, that's a good, it's always a good time for it. It's just, I mean, I like it for its ridiculousness, but it definitely makes no sense.
If there was a seasonal bingo, that would definitely be on the fall bingo.
you know, actually it should have been on there for was like Jarrett Stidham. I mean, I knew that he was a better runner because I went back and took out the sacks, but like, the fact that he doesn't have more rushing yards, given what an effective rusher he is pretty ridiculous, and it's all owed to that.
Yep.
Should we even do percentage chance of victory in this game?
I guess 99?
Said 100.
Yeah, I'll say 100.
Is there anything in particular we're looking for in this game, besides to stay healthy?
Stay healthy and win.
Yeah, I mean, always that, but I think it'd be nice to win by 50.
It will be interesting because, I mean, this is now the Huskies' only opportunity, really, you know, to kind of look at their depth. Before then, they will go start conference play relatively early in week 3 of the season. So things will get serious in a hurry here.
Is there one last thing? If they weren't already. When was that game scheduled?
I think it was before last season. I think it was summer 2017.
Okay, so it wasn't too long ago. Like, is there's no return trip or anything, right? It's just this one-off game that the Huskies went to Atlanta to play them.
Yes.
Is there any particular reason that they had to do it? Was it just to appease you people? And by you people, I mean ESPN.
National media.
I mean, first off, national media picked UW to beat Alabama before the the Peach Bowl. I don't know if you recall that.
Did they?
Well, that was on the bulletin board.
Oh, the bulletin board.
It was just attributed to, quote, national media in caps when one national media member picked Huskies in that game.
It was you.
It was not me. No, 100% was not me.
On college game day, I think 3 out of 4 picked UW. So.
I mean, look, they definitely did need to play a game like this. Whether that needed to be in a neutral site game in Atlanta is another question, but I'm sure that they were compensated handsomely for making that trip.
Okay, sure. Fine. I mean, if that's it, then whatever. But it would just be nice to have a neutral site game happen in Portland or whatever. Like,
really, just not as much interesting college football in Portland. That doesn't involve Oregon.
Why don't we have a neutral site game that takes place at CenturyLink Field then?
Okay,
it'll be on a neutral site.
We can talk about that one. They did play Air Force there many years ago in Ty Willingham's first game. I don't know if you recall.
Yeah.
Didn't win that one. So. Wait. Of course they lost.
Chalking that up to Ty Willingham. But it would be nice, even in, let's say, Los Angeles or something. I don't know.
I don't know if you're aware of this. People are way more interested in college football in the South than they are in the West.
It's frustrating to have to go to Auburn. I mean, they were setting themselves up to fail in this game. Like, if they won, it wouldn't have been a miracle. It would have been...
But they would have gotten credit for it.
It would be more unlikely for them to have won than people would have realized.
I think they would have gotten credit for it. I mean, I think they got, first off, a lot of coverage for this game and an appropriate level of respect coming out of it.
Should they be ranked in the top 10 after this?
I mean, they probably won't be, but yes. I mean, it would, like, the coming in, they were slight underdogs. And even though the final margin was actually 5 points, it looked like a game that they had like a 45% chance of winning. Like,
what if they
played
to expectations? Swap places?
I think that would be fair.
We're fine with that, right? And they'll still be in the top 10. I mean, they shouldn't be punished too much for this loss.
Yeah, basically, they just have to win out.
Great.
So I'm looking at the ESPN FPI projections. There's one game on the entire schedule with less than a 70% chance of victory. Can you guess which one it is?
I assume that's at Oregon, or maybe yes, hosting Stanford.
At Oregon.
So they give them hosting Stanford a 70% chance of victory?
Yeah, 71.5.
Is a Stanford alum, still stand by your, the Huskies will win by what was it during the first quarter of that?
I think it was 60 points.
Yeah, yeah, you're standing by that one?
Maybe 40 is more realistic. More of a repeat of 2016. Was that the game where it was like Friday night and Stanford went to Seattle and just got crushed? Yeah. I could see that happening again. So I've only seen the first half of the Stanford-San Diego State game, and Stanford just looked terrible. And apparently they did things in the second half.
They did.
So, so maybe it's not as bad, but going to Seattle is a pretty tough challenge. So I think the percent chance is probably about right, or maybe even low for
UW. I get the Huskies 10% to win that game.
I'll take Stanford plus 40. Let me go out on that one.
going into it, it want nothing to do with any of these
it was games. Interesting. I was staying on Friday night at the Palo Alto Sheraton, and that and the Westin next door were like largely populated by mostly Stanford fans and like family of the team, but also some San Diego State folks. And it would have been a very dark place if Stanford had in fact lost to San Diego State, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, at least school hasn't started yet, so no students are there to experience the lows if they lost. And they did lose to San Diego State last year, in part because of Rashad Penny. So Stanford is partially responsible for the Seahawks drafting him in the first round, but that's neither here nor there.
Another strike against Stanford.
Thanks, David Shaw. Okay, on that note, we thank you so much for your time, Ben B., and maybe everyone be on the lookout for a little more from you later this week on the NFL.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
And as a reminder, you can follow him on Twitter now at Ben B. Baldwin. Don't go to Google31BB anymore. And then check him out on The Athletics Seattle. Okay, so again, thanks to Ben B. for joining us. Always a treat for hear from him, and nice to get a little preview of what's coming on The Athletic Seattle, even if it's depressing news for the Seahawks standpoint.
Love to hear that.
The Seahawks have less chance of winning than you thought, my research. As I mentioned there, during the Husky game, the Sounders started out down 1-0 at home to Sporting Kansas City, gave up a goal in the second minute, but alas, things turned around thereafter as they came up with the 3-1 victory, their eighth in a row.
Oh my God.
Breaking the MLS single season shootout, single season record in the post shootout era. Just as many caveats as we can get on there.
What is the win record in the pre shootout era?
I don't know, but every game had a winner. So it was much more, you know, like now you have the possibility of a draw. So
still,
streaks
this
are much
is
harder
a lot of
cost.
Games in
it
a row.
It is a lot of games in a row.
They have to be pushing that record. I'm just saying most MLS wins in a row ever.
They got to get 12 if you're taking out the single season qualifier. One team won 12 in a row across two seasons. That's going to be a lot.
Look, we all know that you only count one season at a time. Joe DiMaggio didn't play.
That's true. It'll be several months, though, before the Sounders get to the 12 matches necessary to potentially tie that record. In this particular game, as mentioned, Sounders gave up the early goal, but then equalized through Raul Ruiz Diaz 10 minutes later, and then added a pair of goals in a 5-minute span just after halftime. An acrobatic Graham Zusi finish for an own goal off a Harry Ship corner. It was a really like clinical finish from Graham Zusi. Impressive stuff there. And then Nico Ladero adding a goal from the spot after a penalty.
I was reading that just being like, do the Sounders have Graham Zusi now?
No, they don't. They had him for that one play. The Sounders, again, pretty lucky in terms of expected goals to win this game. Sporting Kansas City.
They've won two consecutive games now because of own goals.
That's helpful. Sporting Kansas City had the advantage in terms of the 538 expected goal model. So that was interesting. These bad news for the Sounders last weekend is the rest of the Western Conference also did pretty well. So the Sounders still tied for fifth in the conference with 41 points, but now just five out of second place in the West after being mired near the basement much of the season. They're tied for fourth in the West in terms of points per match at 1.58. Amazingly, the Sounders will not be winning a match this weekend, and that's because it is the international break coming up here. So no match for the Sounders. We'll be back in 2 weeks. The international break for the women was last weekend, and that means the Seattle Reign are back in action this weekend. It's a showdown, as we mentioned last week, with the derby match with the Portland Thorns.
Huge derby win for the Sounders on Saturday against Sporting Kansas City.
With second place in the NWSL and the chance to host a semifinal on the line, we know that the Reign and Thorns will play. One of them will be the second seed. One of them will be the third seed. We just don't know which is which. The Reign head into this week's game Sunday in Portland, just needing a result, either a draw or a win. The Thorns do need a win to finish second and host the semifinal. The 538 Soccer Power Index projections make that close to a toss-up, a 53% chance of a Reign win or draw, a 47% chance of a Thorns win because of home field advantage in this one. Portland will be playing without forward Haley Rosso, who was lost a season-ending back injury in their last match. The strength of this Thorns team, who won the 2017 NWSL Championship, is their midfield with Canadian star Christine Sinclair and Tobin Heath from the U.S. Women's National Team. So, you know, the Reign will have to really control that matchup in order to potentially pull out this result on the road in a crucial matchup for them to wrap up the regular season. Speaking of the importance of home court advantage, or home field in that case, but home court advantage, the Storm are hoping it comes up meaningful in Game 5 of their WNBA semifinal series against the Phoenix Mercury, where they've been pushed the distance after taking a 2-0 lead at home. The last time we potted, the Storm were up 1-0 in the series. They took a 2-0 lead when they survived a Phoenix comeback from down as many as 19, got back-to-back Diana Taurasi threes to force overtime, but the Storm rebounded there and pulled out the victory. Phoenix kind of dominated in Game 3, a game where the Storm shot poorly, and then Game 4 was a back-and-forth nervy affair. The Storm took a huge lead early, but then lost Sue Bird in the second quarter to the fifth broken nose of her career, fourth while playing for the Storm.
That's kind of crazy, right?
It's a lot. I mean, someone asked her today at practice, like, you know, why does this happen so many times? And her line is, you know, my nose is at the perfect height, which, you know, it kind of collides with post players, which is what happened here. She was defending on a play. Brianna Stewart was just in the way, and Sue kind of ran into her elbow, and you knew immediately that it was broken from where the connection was made and the level of blood. She actually tried to come back and play in this game. They have the mask because of the fact that she's broken it so many times.
Yeah, they
travel
they
with it.
They know.
But she had bleeding. It didn't look like it was quite as bad as maybe Steve Nash, if you remember, and when he tried to play in a playoff game many, many years ago and when I was able to do so because they couldn't stop the bleeding. But she was on the sideline, just basically operating as an extra assistant coach as Phoenix came back from a deficit as large as 17 points to take a 4-point lead at one point in the fourth quarter. Storm marched back and did tie it in the final minute, but Phoenix, a big offensive rebound by former Storm forward Camille Little, turned into Brittany Griner's score in the final 15 seconds to give Phoenix the lead, and the Storm did not get off a shot attempt in the closing seconds as Griner shut down Brianna Stewart's attempt to drive the basket.
Wow. Well, the good news is Diana Taurasi isn't very good in elimination games.
No,
right?
No track record of winning these kind of games at all. 13-0 all series time in winner-take-all games in the WNBA.
What has to happen for the Storm to win this game?
Well, they have to score more points.
They're not going to win a close game. We know that.
They're not
Diana Taurasi is not going to lose a close game. Did you see Game 2?
I did see Game 2. I saw all of Game 2. I've seen Giant Atrocity in an elimination game at Key Arena before in 2011. The story, a kind of situation that kind of played out similar to this, although it was a 3-game series back then in the first round. Storm won Game 1 pretty comfortably, looked like they were going to win the series. Phoenix won Game 2, sent it back home to Seattle for Game 3, and Diana took over in the fourth quarter and propelled them to victory.
I mean, the percentage chance of victory for Phoenix are like 100% here.
I mean, there can't be 100%. Like, first off, Phoenix has not beaten a lot of teams that had 26 wins during the regular season on the road in the streak, although they have actually won more of the 13 winner-take-all games on the road than they have at home. It's 7-6.
Oh my God.
It's really,
even if the Storm have a lead, you're not going to feel comfortable until the game is over.
Now, that's 100% true. I mean, you could lead by 30 points, and it's just like, you got to keep driving the stake into the heart.
I feel like 30 is the number.
Feel comfortable.
If it gets to 30 and it's in the second half, then you can calm down a little bit.
Okay.
That's the number. Anything less, 29 points, 30 points in the first half, no calm down.
I mean, it's definitely going to be a thrilling game. It's going to, like, you know, obviously it would have been great for the Storm to know that they were going to advance to the finals. But from a neutral observer perspective, like, it's going to be an awesome game on Tuesday night. And I hope everybody who can make it out gets a chance to come watch this game.
Are you
going to
fantasy draft during the game?
Our fantasy draft is not tomorrow, is it?
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Then I guess I'm going to have to do a lot of auto drafting.
I'm going to do it from mobile. I have other things that I have to deal with also. It's going to be an interesting draft.
So the winner of this game, of course, moves on to play in the WNBA Finals. We don't yet know who they would play in that matchup because the other semifinal between the Atlanta Dream and Washington Mystics has also gone the distance, and they will play their Game 5 Tuesday night at 5 p.m. Pacific, just before the Storm game at 7 p.m. Pacific. So everything on the line, and if the Storm advances, I think we're going to have to do an emergency pod previewing the WNBA Finals.
All right.
So I think that's pretty much all we have this week. Sadly, I don't think either of us have seen Ballers. There's going to be no after Ballers.
We're gonna have to catch up on Ballers later. And as you know, we already called the season for the Mariners. So hot takes have been retired.
It was the right call. I mean, their playoff odds are down under 10% at this point. They are falling fast after they lost. Was that a 4-game series in Oakland? I don't know. They lost some games in Oakland.
I feel like people have completely stopped. I don't even see Mariners tweets anymore.
I happened to run into Seattle Times Mariners reporter Ryan Divish in the airport on Sunday night before my flight home.
Name dropping again.
I know. So I got some updates on the Mariners from him.
What were the updates? He's not paying attention.
He's paying attention. I also actually I went to a sports bar in Palo Alto to watch the Storm game on Sunday, and I had it so I could see the Mariners A's game on a different screen. So I got both of those losses at the same time there.
And the Mariners now sit 6 games back of the wild card, closer to the Tampa Bay Rays than they are to the Oakland A's.
Yeah, don't think it's happening. Don't think it's happening for the Mariners. That's the cold take.
With how many games are left? They're 76 and 61.
I believe it is 35.
Oh, that's actually, that can't be right.
Or 25, 25.
I was going to say, 26 games back with 25 to go.
That's going to be tough.
There's probably a chance, but
Fangraphs says it's like 8%, 7 or 8%. So yeah, probably not happening.
It's going to be a fun offseason.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.